Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, in Business Week recently, we had an interview and story with SEC Commissioner Gary Gensler, which, you know, I sort of helped initiate. And the one of the main things that I just wanted to understand was what the SEC is going to do about a potential Bitcoin ETF. What about his comments resonated with you?
Yeah, so we've been tracking this for, 7 years now. I call it the Kentucky Derby for ETF nerds. Since the Winklevoss filed in 2013, I believe it was, when Bitcoin was trading at $99, by the way, all these ETFs have been filed with the SEC. And, you know, when you look at what really has taken place over those years, it's all been ETFs that would track Bitcoin like the way GLD tracks gold. So that would be a physically backed, even though people mock me for saying physically on Twitter, but it's physically backed as you can get. In other words, it would store the Bitcoin and track the spot price the way GLD tracks gold. However, Gensler has come in, and we thought he would be a little more lenient on Bitcoin because he was an expert in it. But he has come in and really been a little concerned about approving physically backed Bitcoin ETFs because they are filed under the Securities Act of 1933. Which is a looser rule than the 1940 Act, which is has more protections. That's what all your mutual funds and most ETFs are registered under. So there's a lot more protections in there, and I think he feels more comfortable if an ETF that tracked Bitcoin were filed under there. So the only way to go through the 40 Act and be Bitcoin is to use futures.
What happened in the days after we published that story?
Yeah, so since he said that and the story came out, there's been, I believe there's now five Bitcoin ETFs that are now filed that would track futures under the 40 Act. So there's almost like a new Kentucky Derby forming in the shadow of the bigger one. And it sounds like that's what's, you know, if all goes well and he is a man of his word, it will probably see these futures ETFs approved in November. As early as November, at least, and that's what we're going to get. So we should really look into how they work. And we have two people on today who literally run Bitcoin futures strategies into fund structure. So I think we could get a real inside look at how they're going to work and the pros and cons of them.
Okay, so joining us for this episode, Steve Hawkins of Horizon ETFs. He's coming back on. You may remember him from the Shroom episode a couple months ago. And then Simeon Hyman at ProShares, who just a couple weeks ago launched one of these future strategies. This time on Trillions, a look into the future of Bitcoin futures ETFs. Simeon, Steve, welcome to Trillions.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me again, man.
Okay, Simeon, I want to start with you because this your product came out literally just a couple of weeks ago. How did you come up with this idea? Because it was something that you put in motion, obviously, months ago.
Well, we've actually been focused on the Bitcoin space for quite a while. But we did indeed, we're very proud a couple of weeks ago to be the first to market, to bring the first Bitcoin exposure in a mutual fund. It's ticker BTCFX. That's our Bitcoin Strategy Pro Fund. We have both Pro Shares ETFs and Pro Funds mutual funds at our organization. And this is indeed a strategy that utilizes futures for exposure to Bitcoin and puts that in a 40 Act mutual fund, as Eric was indicating. And I always like to be careful with SEC language. The strategy was allowed to come to market. Remember, the SEC doesn't approve anything. They allow things to come to market. But we were really excited to be first on this one.
And so let me ask you how this works, right? So this filing is called a Bitcoin Strategy Fund, which is what all of the new filings are sort of called. And they're all active, right? So this is an active strategy. How does it, a typical futures ETF like, natural gas or something would take the front 2 months probably and then just try to roll them constantly to keep exposure. Does this go beyond those front 2 months? Does it use other funds like some of these filings are saying they can use futures and or other funds, like presumably a Canadian Bitcoin fund or something. So can you just really take us through how the strategy works and what it holds?
Sure. So the basic intent is to use the front month contracts for exposure. And the benefit of that historically is that the correlation volatility and beta of those front month contracts to spot Bitcoin is really high. Now, we are an active fund, so that means we do have some ability around the margin to manage the roll. You know, you've got to roll from at the end of the month, you got to roll to the next month. So we have some ability as an active fund to say, oh, we see a lot of liquidity today. We're going to roll a little more than we intended, a little less tomorrow. And there is a little bit of a room around the edges to think about, you know, where the collateral behind the margin, the futures contracts are invested. But still, the primary intent for the exposure is to be invested in those front month contracts.
So how's it going so far? Because obviously this is something that, as Eric said, he's been watching for 7 years. There's been a ton of people interested in it. You come out with something that is a close approximation of what everybody's going to be moving towards, and instant feedback. How's it going?
It's going pretty well from our perspective. We've seen the flows started to come in. Look, it's also been a period where you know, Bitcoin is on the rise. So that brings some extra eyeballs, and the fund is doing what it's supposed to do. And we're seeing some nice flows.
And I just want to get wonky real quick. I know Steve's waiting in the wings, but we just got to get through this mutual fund real quick. This mutual fund, right? So a lot of the filings that are coming into the SEC will say something along the lines of, we're going to track futures and potentially some other funds that hold Bitcoin. And I guess that, and I think some of you mentioned OTCs, OTC trusts, which would mean GBTC. Does this one hold any of those? Was that in the language? And do we think that Gensler will actually filter out ones that have that? And because now we're seeing filings come in that just say just futures. And there's some talk that those are the ones he'll approve. Any thoughts on all that?
So I don't want to sort of guess as to what the SEC might do or what they're sort of signaling. But, you know, back to my earlier point, you know, because we are active, that means we do have some ability to think about how the cash is invested, particularly the margin behind those contracts. So we can use a few things other than cash. Again, it's not the dominant intent of the strategy. The strategy, you know, per its prospectus indicates a focus on those front month contracts, but there's a little bit of ability to think about where the cash is sitting.
And just to be clear, the 1940 Act requires funds that hold securities, whereas you can fall into the 33 Act and not hold securities, and Bitcoin isn't a security, right? So you file under the 40 Act because you're not, futures aren't securities either, but you get the margin and you buy treasuries with them, and then presumably that's what you're holding. Therefore, you get through. Am I right on that, or am I missing anything?
So I'm going to focus on, I think, what's important to the investor in the distinction between the 40 and the 33 Act, because for folks who are tuning in, the 33 Act is a common structure for commodity exposure as compared to the 40 Act structure, which these are named for the year in which they were put in place, 1933 and 1940. The key distinction as an investor, there is a real benefit to being in a 40 Act, and that is perhaps most importantly the avoidance of the annoying K-1. Most 33 Act funds will generate a K-1. You got to deal with that when you file your taxes. When you're in 40 Act space, you get a plain old 1099. So that's probably the most salient difference from an investor's perspective.
Okay, Steve, I want to bring you in here. Because in addition to the shroom conversation that we've had with you, you're also in the Bitcoin space, which basically sounds like a pretty fun job. How do you get, what's your read on the whole 33?
Marijuana.
Yeah, okay, marijuana too. So what's your read on the 3340 acts, and what's your distinction?
Well, I mean, I would just step back for a second and look at it from our perspective. So we launched our Bitcoin futures index tracking ETF back in April this year. We were in a race with a few other, digital currency, Eric, from a digital, not physical asset perspective. So we had our synthetic futures-based product. They had their digital asset holding the physical digital currency themselves. And we really thought that our regulators in Canada were actually going to go down the same route as what the SEC has said. And so we believed that we were going to be able to get the first Bitcoin ETF to market here in North America using futures as the underlying asset class rather than the physical digital currency. We just really didn't think that they could get there on the market making and all of the sort of issues around liquidity that could occur directly with the holding the digital asset in the ETF custody account, if you can even call it that, and getting like the regulators themselves understanding the custody and the risks around custody of the digital asset themselves. And I think that's exactly what has, you know, been holding up the SEC for very, very long with all of the comment letters that we've seen on the physical Bitcoin filing. So that's why we went really hard down the route of the futures based ETF here. And obviously the regulators approved the physical digital asset ETFs before the futures, and we were quote unquote novel. And so we had to go down that road, and we launched about a month after the physical products themselves, or a little bit over a month. And, you know, from our take, we really truly believe that futures is the best place from this asset class to get exposure. Still, we believe that, you know, all of the efficiency of market making and how an ETF actually works is best through of underlying futures exposure in the ETF. And that's both long, and also we launched inverse Bitcoin shortly after that, because we're giving these things as trading vehicles. And if people want to use them as trading vehicles, then we believe that the futures is really the best place to go. And that's why we agree with the SEC in that regard.
Well, but let's dive into this. So unfortunately, you came out a month after the physically backed ones. But whether you're looking at the gold area, where the futures gold ETF has 1% of the assets in the physically backed gold ETFs like GLD and IAU, in your case, this one has about 1% of what the physically backed big ETF has in Canada. It's a very almost the exact parallel, which basically shows the same thing. People just want it physically backed. But you're saying that futures are better. Seems against the grain. Like, even someone, I know you want to want people to use the Bitcoin futures ETF, for sure. But like, it just seems like nobody would agree with that.
Well, first to market, Eric, right? So if our Bitcoin futures ETF was first to market, you would not be seeing 100-to-1 from an assets perspective. 100%,
sure.
Right? It's just underlying Bitcoin exposure that they were going for, and it was who was providing the first and access to it in a liquid vehicle that could be traded on the exchange every day. I mean, we had a closed-end fund here in Canada, or a couple of closed-end funds that had over $1 billion of assets. And, you know, they were trading at a 25, 30% premium to the net asset value every day. Guess what happened to that premium on the day that a Bitcoin ETF got listed? It's now trading at a 10% discount, right? Like, because the people don't want to be locked up into a vehicle that they can't trade in and out of on a regular basis. And, you know, when you look at the efficiency of what ETFs do in the marketplace, market makers have to trade this. They have to provide a bid-ask spread, and they have to be able to hedge that exposure and actively trade that hedge as they buy and sell units in the marketplace. What are they hedging against any Bitcoin ETF right now, whether it be physical or futures-based? They are using futures, because that's the only vehicle that they can trade intraday to hedge their underlying buying and selling activity. And guess what? If you're a futures-based ETF and your market maker is using futures to hedge their exposure, they're getting one-to-one direct contraining exposure. When that happens with a Bitcoin digital currency physically backed ETF, they're trading futures against it. There's gap, and there's always going to be gap risk in that regard. And, you know, it is what it is from that perspective. And so we believe that, again, as the market sort of evolves here and becomes matures from a market efficiency perspective in trading Bitcoin, there's more Bitcoin products out there. We believe that investors will lean towards where markets are more efficient from a trading perspective, and the ETF should trade it more efficiently. You know, we can accept futures and deliver futures as part of the creation redemption baskets, again, making it more efficient for the liquidity providers in the marketplace. So it's a very, okay, very different asset.
I'm not a trader, I'm a normie. Futures isn't something I normally think about touching. So how does this market work? What do I need to know about it? Who lists them? How big of a marketplace are we talking about here? Can you guys break that down for me? Simeon, I'll start with you.
Yeah. So among the benefits of the futures market is the regulation. The futures market is governed by the CME and the CFTC. There is a central clearinghouse that ensures that trades are not defaulted upon, and that those are really important aspects. Again, we can't be in the mind of the SEC, but we know what the advantages are. And exactly to Steve's point, the more that there are opportunities for Bitcoin exposure, the more volume and the more liquidity we see in these markets. But even in, and so, simply you're buying a futures contract for what the market thinks the price of Bitcoin would be a month from now. And as I mentioned, the tracking of that has been pretty close to spot. But everybody likes to talk about roll cost. That's everybody's favorite thing to talk about. It was any second Eric was going to ask me. So I will throw a couple of comments on it before he even asked. He's so upset he didn't get to ask it. So I'll just pretend he asked it. So think about this.
He's in my head.
In 2020, Bitcoin, spot Bitcoin, I think was up about 305%. If you looked at a strategy that, approximated rolling 1 month contracts, you would have gotten about 285. So everybody goes, oh my God, there was 20% roll cost. The market was up 305. I mean, the only way there's meaningfully positive roll cost is when market participants think the thing is going up. That's first principles. In jargony terms, the future is the unbiased estimator of the future spot price. So, yeah, I mean, if it's up 305 and you got 285, I don't think anybody's going to be so worried about that. In a more normalized environment, it's very likely roll costs would be smaller. And the more of us that get involved in this, the more liquid the stuff is. That being said, I think ultimately there will be many different ways to get exposure. And also to Steve's point, they all come with costs. We know how big that premium and discount is to the thing or things that are trading over the counter. We don't even, it's hard to even get your hands around the opaqueness of the transaction costs if you're trying to get a digital wallet. So there's no free way to get exposure. It's like the stickers on all the ETFs. You cannot get the exact return of the theoretical index. It doesn't exist.
Eric, are you going to try and ask a question about roll cost now?
Send it my way, Eric. And I'll.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. Look, I agree. That's a very good point. I mean, you're up 285. We always say that about the shiny object lane. Nobody cares about fees over there because if you hit it, you're tripling the S&P like ARK, right? Nobody cares. They charge whatever 75 basis points. So I get it. I think maybe let's put it into proportion of the fact that when the physically backed ETFs, if they were to come out, probably would track more of that upside, but also the downside. So I don't know. It just seems to me that in general, and futures are a fine way to get exposure to many different areas. Typically, though, if you can get it the physically backed way, people tend to prefer it. Like we went up in Canada and just discussed that, and in gold. But the idea, I think, is just that humans that are investors generally just want something that tracks the price. That they just want the Kelly Blue Book value. Like, just don't complicate this for me. That would be my one pushback on that. But to your point, if there's nothing else in the market, like if Steve's fund had gotten out a month before the physically backed, I think he would have been bigger, had liquidity, and been stronger. So in Simeon's case, let's say these futures ETFs come out. And they're out for, well, let's just start there. How do you think the SEC is going to approve or allow these ETFs? Are they going to put out like all four or five at once? Will they pick some? How much do you attention and assets do you think they'll get relative to, let's say, a physically backed ETF getting introduced, which we think would be $10 billion within a month?
Wow. So one, let's look at physical gold versus a digital currency wallet, right? And who custodies that? How is it held? Is there risk to that underlying asset? Can somebody hack your vault at Fort Knox and remove your gold and sell it somewhere else? This is not Goldfinger anymore, right? But cybersecurity and hacking is like, this is something we have to live with for the rest of our lives. And will somebody be able to, at some point in time, hack Gemini Trust and figure out how to take money out of the digital currency ETF that's there, you know what? I don't know, but I'm not going to take that chance. And I'm not, if I'm invested in my gold, physical gold ETF, I know that I'm not going to lose my physical gold anywhere at any time under any circumstances, unless somebody misplaces it, which I don't think can happen either, because, you know, we have a very, very strong settlement cycle and way of trading gold and physical gold, even gold futures. But with digital currencies, when you're dealing with, you know, exchanges that are getting hacked from time to time, you're dealing with custody arrangements, which are getting hacked from time to time, you're dealing with a lot of unknowns, as Simeon was saying, with respect to the actual trading of the, you know, of the digital Bitcoin. And it'll be very, very interesting when sort of we have interim financial statements coming out right now for the physical Bitcoin ETFs here in Canada. And we really don't know that underlying trading costs and custody costs and flow through costs until we get, this will be the first public reporting period for those ETFs. So it'll be very, very different from that perspective. I also wanted to say, like, also to Simeon's point, when you're looking at the backwardation and contango of, you know, the futures curves for Bitcoin, you know, since the inception of the Bitcoin futures back to 2017, it wasn't really only until like the last 12 months, even less, like 10 months, where we saw this huge sort of, you know, contango effect, which started creating tracking error between sort of BTC1 on a long-term basis versus spot Bitcoin. And to Simeon's point, like, we created a 5-day rolling futures index. And, you know, on a 1-year basis right now, we're about, you know, 35% behind, you know, that 301% return of BTC1, right? And, you know, our rolling futures, there's a cost to it. And it's only really been in the last year since Bitcoin has been going straight up from your point of $99 to $60,000, something's going to happen during that period from a contango perspective and a futures curve. It's just, you know, reality. But when you normalize it, and when you normalize gold to gold futures, like, this is a marketplace where we believe that futures will be, again, the best tracking vehicle, because you've got to take the contango with the backwardation. And as, you know, we see Bitcoin slide, the backwardation really fits nicely into allowing us to really make up some of that gap as long as we're fully invested, which is, you know, what all our ETFs are hoping to be. But I mean, Simeon's might be a little bit different because it's active. Ours is passive and 100% invested at all times. So,
Simeon, I want to ask you, you know, you coming out just recently, and then all of a sudden you see all these new filings, handful of them that Eric mentioned earlier. I'm sure you've had a chance to look at them. What do you make of those offerings?
Yeah, so we have filed for an ETF. We're in the quiet period, so there isn't much else I can say other than we filed. And this is a rapidly evolving and maturing space. I think when we get to some steady state, there will be multiple ways for investors to get exposure to Bitcoin. And I think perhaps one of the best things that you can do as an investor is try to split up the underlying use case for Bitcoin from the alternatives as an investor. I think that's really important, and it gets lost if you're trying to do this research, because, you know, whether it's the anonymity, the functioning of the blockchain, the evolution of DeFi, all those things that are part of the underlying value proposition of Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency are critical to, you know, what will drive its price over time. But you don't need a smelter to invest in gold. So those things are not necessarily the relevant question. The relevant question, as more ways are allowed to come to market to get exposure, is to ask yourself the questions of, as an investor, trade off the transaction costs of being in the spot market, in the futures market, if there is ultimately that choice. The trade-off of being in a 40 Act versus a 33 Act in terms of your, you know, personal tax positions or your predilection for a K-1. So I think that's what's really important, because that can get so lost so fast, because you go into the, into the Al Gore's World Wide Web, and you try to figure out what's going on with Bitcoin, and all of a sudden you're reading the Satoshi paper, and you don't know how that's going to help you. So I think if there's a piece of to take away here, as an investor, focus on the relevant distinctions in what it means to you as an investor. Leave the underlying use case commentary perhaps a little bit to the side for that evaluation.
Okay, let's take a step back and look at what might transpire. So, you know, we just talked about there's other filings. So here's exactly what Gensler said that everybody has honed in on, which is, quote, "I anticipate there will be filings with regard to ETFs under the 40 Act. When combined with the other federal securities laws, the 40 Act provides significant investor protections. Given these important protections, I look forward to the staff's review of such filings, particularly if those are limited to these CME-traded Bitcoin futures." Now, all of the filings, the first three filed, including yours, Simeon, VanEck, yours, and Invesco, have this language, which says, "The fund intends to invest in pooled investment vehicles, including ETFs that invest directly or indirectly in Bitcoin." The last two that came in, Valkyrie and Galaxy, simply say we're only futures. They don't have that ETFs indirect Bitcoin sentence. Does that matter? And how do you see the approval working? Do you think they'll approve all five at once? Because when you file 40 Act, you're on like a 75-day clock, right? So it seems like the first one filed could be out first. I don't know. Just give me your take on all that.
I can't really opine on what the SEC might do, which I know you'd love for me to do. We don't know. We really don't know. It's pretty clear from the language that, you know, Gensler is a fan of futures and a 40 Act. But at that nuance level, you know, all I can really, you know, respond to is, you know, we're active and we have that flexibility to manage that cash collateral in a little bit more flexible ways than maybe some folks who are painting that a little bit more narrowly.
Steve, the SEC can't harm you. You're up there in Canada. What do you think about that sentence? Do you think that will matter and it'll prove just the two that said only futures, or what's your take?
Well, I wish our regulator had the same thought process as Gensler. First and foremost, because then I would have been first to marketplace. But that said, I believe he's really honing in on the fact of how can they get comfortable from a regulatory perspective around custody and trading of the underlying assets when this is such a new and you know, every day it's changing with respect to how you can access digital currencies or and how you can hold digital currencies. So this is an unregulated cross-border currency asset, and it's just a complete unknown for them. But having the regulated CME-listed futures governed by the CFTC, as Simeon was saying, where you have full-on margin accounts, segregated margin accounts with a different trust, which is what we had to do with our ETF. You know, these are all, I think, these are all the comfort levels that is giving the regulator saying, I think we can get there now with the sort of ETF futures based. And I think, you know, I think there's five or six filings now, which are futures based specifically in the US. I believe that they're all going to get approved. And I believe that hopefully the SEC will approve them all together. Like if they're going to approve one, they should be approving all of them together roughly around the same time. So for the people that are on the fence with their physical ones, like the cryptoins and the Wise and the First Trust, you know, I think they should be getting their, you know, futures based filings in ASAP so that they can get onto the train with the rest of the filings like ProShares and Galaxy and Invesco and VanEck and those guys who I think will lead the charge. If not, then I think they're going to be watching as these, you know, U.S. issuers get to marketplace with their first futures-based ETFs.
And to your point, in Canada, they allowed this Bitcoin ETF to come out one day alone, and then they let somebody else come out day two. It was already like too late.
It was.
So I agree. They probably should approve all at once, given what they saw in Canada. Then they, I think they corrected, and the three Ether ETFs all got approved and allowed to launch the same day. And it was more of an even fight.
Correct.
But that's how big First to Market. Now back to you, Simeon. Now you have a mutual fund that's futures and there's an ETF that, let's say the ETFs get filed, launched. What about capacity? Somebody brought up capacity where they thought, well, maybe the mutual fund was approved because the mutual fund can always stop taking new assets. The ETFs can't. Do you think if there's futures ETFs approved and they really get a lot of flows, is there capacity concerns that you can't close, the ETF to new creations? Or I guess you can, but it would just annoy everybody.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of pieces to that. First, it's likely that capacity limits is something that will increase and ameliorate over time. So there are limits, 2,000 limit on the front month traffic. That's about, if you add it all up, it's about $450 million in today's Bitcoin price. But also remember, we are active. So that does give us the opportunity around the edges to manage that process. So I think it's manageable. We would have no intent to convert the mutual fund. We have, as I said, Pro Funds and Pro Shares we have mutual funds and ETFs on the platform. So, we would anticipate that those would coexist for us.
I would add to Simeon's point, the CME has a limit on the front month that you can own. It also has an overall limit. So like we had to build into our prospectus the ability to go to a certain limit on the overall fund, and we could move outside of sort of the index, and we could actively manage the portfolio to the index based on what we were allowed to get exposure to. So if that meant owning the front month, the second month, the third month contracts, so that we were approximating the performance of the front month or the rolling front month index, that's what we had to do. And to Simeon's point, as there are more and more products that are coming to marketplace, there's significantly more trading volume in those underlying Bitcoin futures, which we've seen effectively pick up almost every month since they launched in 2017. There was a bit of a lull in 2018, but like 2019, 2020, the number of contracts outstanding basically has increased every single month, and it's provided more depth to marketplace, more liquidity for us to be able to trade. And, we have been in discussions with the CME, I can openly say, for over 2 years now to try and get them to move those contract limits and give us exemptions away from those contract limits. And, because we actually, licensed the CME futures, pricing and index that they had, they've been very, very open to talk to us about it and understand the issues. And, it's something that we have to deal with our market makers all the time. But to your point, Eric, under Canadian law, we have the ability to cap the ETF very, very quickly and easily. And, the one thing we don't want it to happen, though, is we don't want this to turn into a closed-end fund. We want it to stay an open-ended fund that, people have we don't want it trading at a premium if it's a closed-end fund. It'll never take a discount because they always have the ability, unit holders always have the ability to sell and redeem. But buying it, if we have no more capacity to add exposure, then it typically will end up trading like a closed-end fund and trading at a premium. We just don't want that. So we're hoping the CME, hoping that everybody, with putting a little pressure on the CME, and as that market has become significantly deeper, will relax those individual contract limits that we're up against currently.
Steve, how big do you think your product can get then? What do you think the potential is?
Well, we saw, if we were first to market, I'm just going to say hypothetically, we saw $1 billion come in the first week, right? If we had brought $1 billion in the first week in US dollars, we would have been capped out in the front month contract. We would have been moving into the second month.
Wait. Oh, time out. So that's fascinating. Let's actually grow this to, because you're using the same futures. So how much could Bitcoin futures ETF as a whole, as a group, have in assets, US dollars, before you're capped out?
Any one fund is capped, right? But multiple funds are not.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, but a one fund would be $1 billion.
One fund could be $1 billion. Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
It could be a little bit different for pro shares because the one having a fund and one having an ETF, and both of them, I don't believe that both of them, from my own personal view, I don't believe both of them have the ability to to go up to that 2,000 for a month contract limit under the way that I've read the CME rules. But I could be mistaken, and I'm not Simeon's lawyer, and I'm not going to give him advice there. But you know, it's an entity limit per se, and to the extent that and you know, one of the issues that we were running into is the trading partners when it comes to the there's a limited number of FCMs in the U.S. that are willing actually to trade the Bitcoin futures, and then the margin around those is significantly different. Like when you're putting up 5% margin on a gold futures contract, we're putting up 42 to 45% on a Bitcoin futures contract. Very, very different way of operations for us in managing these underlying portfolios. The one really nice thing that's happened though, recently this year though, is the addition of the mini Bitcoin futures. So that in itself has actually allowed us to really give us the ability to fine tune the exposure in the ETFs to making sure that we're almost 100% matching all the time. So, we have up to, one Bitcoin future, one big Bitcoin future is five contracts. And if we're able to add in a mini contract to round out the exposure where we need to, it's been a lot better for us to manage that way.
And Simeon, how about you? How big do you think your product can get? And then how would that compare if the ETF version were approved?
Yeah, I don't want to throw a specific number out there because, again, because we're active, that gives us a little bit of an ability to manage around if there's enough liquidity to put a little bit past the front month to think cleverly about how and effectively we could manage the collateral and the margin to get a little bit more exposure. So it's a little bit softer when you're on the active side.
Okay.
They could also own ETFs inside. So if they get capped out on a pro funds basis for the maximum number of futures contracts they own, they could easily backfill with other either futures-based ETFs or even some of the digital currency-backed ETFs here in Canada.
Okay, so this was fascinating. We went way down some wormholes. I want to actually just back up for a second. And Simeon, I'll just ask you, how hard is it to actually just compete with like Robinhood on this front? Like I can just open Robinhood as a consumer, the day trading Yahoo, if you will, and like just buy some BTC. Like how hard is it to compete with that?
Oh, I don't think it's hard to compete because I think as an old mentor of mine once said, let 1,000 flowers bloom. There will be multiple ways to get exposure to Bitcoin that will have pros and cons and that will have advantages for different constituencies. There's a heck of a lot of people out there that would not be pursuing their exposure the way you described. But man, when you tell them, wait, there's a mutual fund. Oh, that's pretty clean. So I think there's plenty of room for lots of ways to get exposure. And there was certainly, from our perspective, an underserved or not served at all constituency that'll find the 40 Act vehicle to be quite the attractive alternative.
All right. To close, Simeon, we've asked Steve this before, although I can't remember what it was, and I'll probably ask him again. We always ask folks, what is your favorite ETF ticker that is not your own?
Favorite ETF ticker that is not my own?
I should have told you to prepare, Simeon.
Oh, I didn't. I thought I was going to get a list of the secret questions at the end. Look, how can you go wrong with GLD? So that's pretty
good. There you go. And Steve, have you changed yours?
I do. I have a new favorite now, and it's because we're looking at the space specifically. But SICK, S-I-C-K, is my new favorite ticker, especially from the U.S. ETF. So
amazingly, I don't think we've had that one before.
3X Bear Healthcare. It is just totally sick. So I like it.
Well, then that one's got a good mirror pair with Cure. I always like tickers that are also great bands, like REM, Cure. There's a couple of them. There used to be Bono. That was a Latin America bond fund, but that closed. But yeah, good choice, Steve. Inspiring. Triple leveraged. Wow, look at you. What are you doing in your personal account these days?
I'm playing the leveraged marijuana. That's as well as inverse Bitcoin. Those are my favorites that I like to trade daily.
All right. Simeon, Steve, thanks so much for joining us on Trillions.
Joel, Eric, always a pleasure. Thanks for having us here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Webershow. He's at Eric Balchunas. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.